The Guardian.
Welcome to Politics Weekly Extra. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Last week on the podcast, we talked about divisions among the Democrats and about the battle to come in that party as the Biden presidency looms. But what about the other side of the aisle? What happens to the Republicans? At first glance, things look smoother for them. While Democrats are clearly divided into their different wings, moderates against progressives, Republicans seem a bit more united. That's not meant as a compliment, by the way. It's just that they've closed ranks behind Donald Trump. The loyalty to the leader is so strong, even among Republicans who once loathed him, that it's Trump's party now. The proof is in how few Republicans dare say publicly that Trump has lost the election. When Trump declares himself the real winner, claiming that the election was stolen by a weird conspiracy involving a Venezuelan leader who died 8 years ago, hardly any Republicans dare step forward and say he's wrong. So what does the future hold for the Republican Party? Is that small anti-Trump minority going to get larger once Trump himself has finally gone? Or will his hold remain tight? Are we going to see a Trump campaign for 2024 dominate the next 4 years, or can Republicans get out of the Trump shadow? Now, in coming programmes, we hope to have that conversation with some leading Republicans. But for now, we thought we'd hear the perspective of someone who's been watching the Republicans closely from the outside. Robert Reich was Labour Secretary back in the 1990s under Bill Clinton. Period I remember well, back when I was The Guardian's Washington correspondent. And over the last 4 years, he's been one of the clearest and most effective voices in the opposition to Trump and Trumpism. He's also the Professor of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley. Robert Reich, very good to have you on. Thank you for joining us. You recently wrote a piece for us, for The Guardian, arguing that Americans are being subjected to a stress test and that Republicans are failing that test. Tell us what you meant by that, first of all.
Hi, Jonathan. It's good to talk to you again as well. The Republicans are failing in the sense that the Senate and House Republicans have really not stood up to Donald Trump at all over the last 4 years, with some a few exceptions, John McCain and Jeff Flake, both senators, one who is no longer with us, the other who is no longer with us in the terms of no longer being in the Senate. But most of them have been profiles in cowardice in terms of being unwilling to criticize Donald Trump. And that has been all the way through this escapade, this charade over the last few weeks with regard to Trump contesting the election.
And so when we talk about cowardice, let's get into what that fear is. Is it of him? Because he can be really mean and vindictive on Twitter and give individuals he doesn't like a lashing. Or is it fear of his voters? And we've seen in this month that there are still 70 million or so people who are ready to vote for Donald Trump.
I think it's more fear of his voters. Because you see, the Republican Party has been changed into a cult, and it has become a cult of Donald Trump, in effect. I mean, I think political parties, particularly in the United States, tend to be overrated in terms of their organization and dominance. They are collections of people. They're less rooted in local communities and states than they were 20 or 50 or 100 years ago. They tend to be dominated by political operatives at the top and those people who decide they want to be candidates. Donald Trump came along to fill this void, and he filled it in, as we all know, a remarkably pugnacious and blistering way, full of venom and vindictiveness toward his enemies.
That's a matter of principle, and I'll tell you.
You are the single biggest liar. You probably are worse than Jeb Bush. You are the single biggest liar.
And he created a base, a Republican base, that arguably is different in some very important ways from the Republican base that he found. The Republican base he created, definitely more xenophobic, somewhat more racist. The Republican base that he created also loves Donald Trump. No surprise, Donald Trump wants to be loved. He is the dominant force still in the Republican Party and will continue to be because it is a cult. most of the rest of the Republican Party, certainly the elected Republican officials in Washington, know that. If they care about their jobs, and most of them do, they don't want to rile up Donald Trump because they don't want to rile up the Trump followers.
And there is this fear, isn't there, that if you're an office holder, you will then face a primary, a contest among only Republican voters. And if you haven't been sufficiently loyal to Trump, they'll vote you out. And that did happen in a few places and seems to have brought people into line. Before we get into this question of his continuing hold, and I think that's obviously important, just on this business about how he managed to change and make the capture the Republican Party and make it his own, what was it about him that he was able to do that in 4 years when, say, George W. Bush, for example, couldn't do that in 8 years? It didn't become Bush's property in the way you're describing with Trump. What was it about him that managed to get that lock on the Republican following?
Again, it's important to note that there was not much of a Republican Party to begin with, Jonathan. These parties are rather amorphous. There was not a strong set of beliefs. There were evangelicals in the Republican Party who were very concerned to end abortion rights. But the Republican Party of, let's say, Barry Goldwater, certainly the Republican Party of Dwight Eisenhower, basically had already ceased to exist. So Donald Trump came in with his guns blasting. He had already made a fetish of Barack Obama not being born in the United States, a completely absurd point. And yet it propelled him into prominence among people who wanted to believe that Barack Obama was not legitimate. The first thing he said when he decided to run and announced that he was running was that Mexicans were coming across the border in great numbers and
they're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people.
This kind of language had almost never been heard from a presidential candidate, certainly not from a president. And it galvanized people who hated political correctness. The other element here, very important, is Fox News and right-wing radio, which magnified, amplified everything that Donald Trump said. He was exciting. He was controversial. He was outrageous. And that meant he was the best thing that ever happened to the media, especially right-wing media, but not just right-wing media. I think all American media fed off of the outrage that Donald Trump created.
But cult usually implies small or minority. And there always was a fringe, used that word before, and I think it's right, that did believe in the kind of racism and the xenophobia and particularly the conspiracy theory. That stuff was all around, even to mention the period I mentioned before, in the 90s, that you could find people who believed all kinds of conspiracies about a new world order and so on. In other words, we always knew there was a market for that. But have you been surprised to learn that there is a market that goes to 70 million Americans for that product?
No, because of an additional factor that we have to figure in. It's very powerful, very important. It affects both political parties in the United States. And that is that for the last 40 years, the median wage in the United States has been stagnant. Or to say it another way, the bottom two-thirds of America not only haven't had a raise, but they have, adjusted for inflation, seen their incomes actually decline. This is new in the post-war era. We have not seen this. It generated and has generated a huge amount of anger, anxiety, frustration. And when you have that many people who are so susceptible to the notion that the game is rigged against them, and quite frankly, it has been rigged against them, but it hasn't been rigged against them by Muslims or black people or Latino people or foreign immigrants. It's been rigged against them, frankly, by very powerful, very wealthy forces, the moneyed interests that have overtaken American politics. But that's not what Donald Trump wanted people to believe. He wanted to take that degree of anger, frustration, and kind of underlying suspicion and channel it toward these scapegoats, much safer for the American oligarchy and also much more politically potent.
Winning is easy. Losing is never easy. Not for me, it's not.
I want to hear what you think about this, because it may be something I want rather than expect. And that is the notion that as power drains away from him, so the standing he would have in the eyes of his base will diminish. And I remember a magazine cover once describing, I think it probably was a picture of your old boss, Bill Clinton, the incredible shrinking presidency. And it had a picture of Bill Clinton getting smaller. And I just wondered if somehow the persona of Donald Trump as being this man of success or permanent winner, in the eyes of his base, that crumbles if he is the outgoing loser. And therefore, each day that passes means his base's view of him will itself shrink. As I say, that may be a desire rather than expectation. What do you think?
Well, I share that desire, but I don't share the expectation for the simple reason that this group of 70 million people really do want somebody like Trump to believe in. And unless some other demagogue with the same weird, revulsive talents comes along, the ability to twist the truth, to get people charged up, to get them blaming others, then I think Trump stays the dominant force. He also has talked about running again in 2024. That's a way of keeping himself in play. He has started his own political action committee, which is a way of generating a lot of money for that campaign and also supporting other Republicans over the next couple of years in the midterm elections of 2022 and in 2024. So he will be, just because there's nobody like him, there's nobody approaching him, the dominant force in the Republican Party.
Let's talk about some of these individual Republicans and where they break. You mentioned in your piece for The Guardian the other day, Lindsey Graham, who is a real sort of study in an object lesson in this whole phenomenon, because he was a vocal never Trumper and said in 2016, if we nominate him, we'll lose and we'll deserve to. Then he became this, and he was a big pal of John McCain, who was obviously an anti-Trumper himself. And Lindsey Graham became this ultra-loyalist, and then he wins re-election earlier this month. And again, maybe it was, you know, a naive expectation, but some people thought, okay, with re-election out of the way, he'll speak to his own conscience once again. And yet he's really ultra-loyal to Donald Trump again, and he's saying, sticking with this message that Donald Trump should keep fighting the 2020 election rather than admitting what to everyone else's reality, that Biden has won. What is going on in the mind of someone like Lindsey Graham? He won't face the voters again for another 6 years, you know, when Donald Trump will have surely been and gone. It can't just be fear and cowardice. What is making someone like him stick with even a defeated Donald Trump?
It's an excellent question, Jonathan, and it really goes to the nature and meaning of integrity. I don't know what happened to Lindsey Graham. Lindsey Graham, I don't think he was a giant in terms of profiles and courage in the Senate ever, but he did at least appear to have some integrity. He got behind the truth, and he was negative, very, very negative about some of the things that Donald Trump as a candidate was saying. But he seems to have gone a little bit, it's very awkward for me to say because I'm not a psychologist. I don't know how these people, like Rudy Giuliani is another one, former mayor of New York during 9/11, he had a pretty good reputation and has gone completely nuts.
The company counting our vote with control over our vote is owned by two Venezuelans who were allies of Chavez, are present allies of Maduro, with a company whose chairman is a close associate and business partner of George Soros.
I mean, these people have been infected by Donald Trump in a way that I frankly cannot explain. Maybe it's being around somebody who has that much flamboyant, aggressive, macho power. I just simply can't explain it.
We've seen a couple of prominent conservatives and Republicans, even on the media, and I'm thinking of Laura Ingraham and Tucker Carlson on Fox News, begin to say, look, we don't like it, but we must, you know, just begin to recognize the reality of these votes that didn't go Donald Trump's way. And the response has been absolutely ferocious. Even Tucker Carlson, who some people would think of might be an heir to Donald Trump, even perhaps the nominee for the Republicans in 2024, they get punished and slapped down when they question him. What will it take for the Trump lock on the Republican base? What will it take for that grip to be broken?
I'm not sure what it will take. I'm old enough to remember people who were in the media, very prominent people like Walter Cronkite in the 1960s, who called out Lyndon Johnson and the Vietnam War and enabled America to see the truth that, in fact, Vietnam was a moral catastrophe. And it changed public opinion. Or Edward R. Murrow in the 1950s, who called out the people who were advocating and advancing these notions, these paranoid notions of communist conspiracies, like Senator Joe McCarthy, and changed American public opinion, ended the rule and reign of Joe McCarthy, who was a very negative, destructive force in the United States. Well, who is going to be the prominent group of figures who are trusted enough to call out Trumpism? I don't know, because nobody has that kind of trust any longer. I mean, one of the victims of Trumpism that started to be a victim even before Trump was the sense that we had these neutral arbiters who were trusted by the vast majority of Americans and could tell the truth.
It's absolutely the case that people talk about America now lacking referees on the pitch who are trusted, and therefore it has to operate without that. The battleground now shifts away from the White House, once Biden is in there, to the Congress. What is your read of how Republicans are going to behave there? Mitch McConnell famously said that his whole objective in the Obama period was to ensure Obama only had one term and to deny him any legislative achievements. Do you think if this grip of Trumpism is still there, Republicans in Congress in the next period will just obstruct and thwart Joe Biden every turn, maybe not even allow him these nominees he's chosen for these important positions? Or do you think they will find a different non-Trump approach to politics, a bit like Republicans were on Capitol Hill before Trump came along, where you could make deals and there was negotiations to be had?
I think that Mitch McConnell under Joe Biden will act exactly the same way. Joe Biden was in the Senate. Joe Biden feels and has signaled that he thinks that he can make deals with Republican senators and with Mitch McConnell in particular. I think that he will be sadly disabused of that notion. Mitch McConnell thinks only about his own power, about the Republican Party's power. Mitch McConnell will do anything to keep that power. And that includes digging in his heels once again and not cooperating on anything that Joe Biden wants to do.
Let me put to you something that was said to me by a Republican I was talking to just last week. And he said he was not a fan of Trump personally, but he said, look, he did something that no other Republican could have done, is he's broken the hold of what my source called Bushism, by which he meant a commitment to, as he put it, endless wars in the Middle East, to a policy of free trade, and also a loose and liberal policy on immigration. And his view was it took a maniac like Trump to do it, but Trump had now succeeded in breaking those three positions, and instead a post-Trump Republican Party could be anti-war, it could be anti-immigration, and it could be for domestic reshoring as opposed to offshoring of jobs. And that was going to be a really popular set of messages to particularly working-class blue-collar voters, and therefore Democrats should be very scared. Are you worried by that mix of circumstances that Trump may have achieved?
Well, I'm not worried about that particular mix, because remember, Trumpism, to the extent that it was a philosophy in foreign policy, was about a zero-sum game, assuming that anything that made America better off would come at the expense of everybody else, and anything that made everybody else outside the United States well better off would come at the expense of America. That's not the way the world works. The world, most of the time, is a positive-sum game, in the sense that if you make another country better off through trade and through international diplomacy, through immigration, all sorts of ways, we all become better off. But there is a grain of important truth to the notion that these international aspects of Trumpism, and I'm talking about getting out of the Middle East in particular, or cutting back on this extraordinarily bloated war economy, and also being a little bit conscious of the effects of immigration on the workforce here in the United States in terms of not allowing it to undercut American wages. And the same thing with trade. That is a very important set of insights and a very important set of policy levers that Democrats need to be careful about. Because as I said before, two-thirds of Americans as adults, they are on a downward escalator, economically speaking. And Donald Trump did speak to them. He didn't really improve their situation, but these issues are all relevant to this issue of stagnant wages.
Let's say, and I'm not saying it will be or should be, but let's say Joe Biden decided his defining, animating project these next 4 years was to prevent the return of Donald Trump or Donald Trumpism. In other words, to deal with the root causes that made it possible that 70 million people voted for a candidate like him and to ensure that never happened again. What would a Biden administration and Democratic allies in Congress do to make sure that the kind of seedbed in which Trumpism grew was no longer fertile terrain for the Republicans?
Well, to the extent that the seedbed is related to stagnant incomes or declining incomes among the working class, there are many things that he could do, Joe Biden. He could make it easier to form unions. He could invest substantial sums in education and job training and infrastructure and good jobs. He could lift the minimum wage, lift and increase taxes on the very wealthy who have never been as wealthy as they are now. The billionaires have even done extraordinarily well during the pandemic, and invest in healthcare for the entire population. Capitalism in America is one of the cruelest forms of capitalism practiced anywhere in the world. The only people who have done well, who are practicing and enjoying a kind of socialism in America, are the super rich. They get bailed out. They get all sorts of benefits with regard to subsidies. They have tax cuts. They enjoy a privileged place in America because they have so much political power. And what Joe Biden could do above all else is reduce the power of big money in American politics, make democracy work.
Robert, we always ask a guest on this program to answer a what else question. What else is going on? This week, it has been those appointments that Joe Biden has made. Tony Blinken as Secretary of State, Janet Yellen nominated, it seems, for Treasury, John Kerry, this special role in tackling climate change. What do you make of this first slew of appointments by the incoming president?
Well, they're very competent people. And they're very well-intentioned. They have a lot of support, both from mainstream Democrats and also from the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. Though, and here's the but, they signal the possibility of a return to normal. Joe Biden, on the one hand, does hold out to the American population the promise of we're going to get back to where we were before. This Trump era was an aberration. It was a horrible nightmare for everybody, and we're going to go back to where we were. But the reality is, where we were before led to Donald Trump. We need to be bold in terms of moving to a new kind of era in which the bottom two-thirds of Americans who were so angry, so frustrated, feel so left behind, no longer are in that position.
Robert Reich, it's been a great pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Jonathan.
And there is still a lot to look out for in the US over the next few weeks. But don't forget to listen back to Wednesday's episode of Politics Weekly, where Heather Stewart looked at the top lines from the Chancellor Rishi Sunak's spending review. Hint, the COVID crisis has cost the UK economy a lot. But for now, goodbye. The producer is Danielle Stevens and I'm Jonathan Friedland. As always, please look after yourselves and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.